Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, December 1st, 2024, is by Steve Gillette on the topic of songwriting and the creative process. When I'm in a movie theater, I find it impossible to maintain my objectivity. With the richness of images and the fullness of sound and the intricacies of story and character, I'm swept away. But with all other media, printed or recorded, I have no difficulty maintaining enough detachment to feel that I can evaluate the work. Conversely, from years of fashioning poetic and musical elements in my own work, I find it difficult to give myself over to the magic of a song, especially my own. I'm jaded and, I guess, hard to please. Words are loaded with meaning, even more so when you start to put them together and set them to music. Words play. There is an effect almost like a magnetism when words start to work with each other. This can create a strong pull on the listener, but sometimes the magnets can also repel. We've all had a good laugh at someone else's expense when they said what they thought they meant, and what they said also meant something that they would not have said had they known that what they said meant that. I remember one woman who was so exasperated with her young son, who kept putting her off with, "Just a sec, Mom, just a sec," that she shouted for all the neighbors to hear, "I am sick and tired of sex." There's always the danger that our carefully chosen words will be misheard. Did Jimi Hendrix really say, "Excuse me while I kiss this guy"? Even though words often seem to have their mischievous evil twins or even triplets, ambiguity can also be a good friend to the songwriter. One place where the language of controlled ambiguity can yield real profits is in song titles. This is true in all fields of music, but is most obvious on the country charts. Songs like "She's Actin' Single and I'm Drinkin' Doubles." One of the cleverest ones, I thought, was about the guy at the bar who meets a very attractive woman and things progress toward what might be a romantic adventure, until he notices his wedding ring. And of course, the song is called "On the Other Hand." Wish I'd written that one. A good title can represent the song well to us, pique our curiosity. The title can capture our attention with some common wisdom or a time-honored phrase. Anything that seems to have an extra something about it makes a good title. If it makes us stop and think or seems ironic or poignant, it will pull us into the song. Some phrases take on new meaning within the context of the song. For instance, the old saying "family tradition" means something very different when Hank Williams Jr. makes his unapologetic explanation of the irresponsible behavior that he shares with his dad, Hank Sr. A few song titles from familiar sayings are "As Time Goes By," "Behind Closed Doors," "Big Girls Don't Cry," "Good Time, Charlie," "That'll Be the Day." When does time-honored wisdom become a cliché, and does that necessarily mean that a phrase has lost its charm? You can start with even the most worn-out old saw, and with a good idea you can add another dimension to it by using it in a way that shows that you know full well what you're saying and what you're saying by saying it. Here are a few examples of an old saying with a new twist. "I've got friends in low places." "I second that emotion." "Stop in the name of love." "We'll burn that bridge when we come to it." Many wonderful songs have been written with people's names in the title, sometimes just a name and sometimes a memorable phrase with the name. Here are some of the women's names: Billie Jean, Delilah, Lucille, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and some of the men: Bad, Bad Leroy Brown, Hey Joe, I'm Henry VIII, Johnny B. Good, Louie Louie, and Mr. Bojangles. And what about place names? The Battle of New Orleans, California Dreamin', Dixie, Does Fort Worth Ever Cross Your Mind, and Moonlight in Vermont. Synesthetics literally means a mixture of senses. The language of sight, smell, taste, feel, and sound can make a moment in the song come to life. This phenomenon may also account for the longevity of some songs, which seem to connect with us at a deep and possibly unconscious level. In the Van Morrison classic, Brown Eyed Girl, there are lines like slipping and sliding all along the waterfall with you and making love in the green grass behind the stadium. In my book, Songwriting and the Creative Process, I offered what I called the stack of plates theory. It's as if a song is actually a stack of song issues. You can develop the ability to examine each layer for its own values and to more effectively understand the interaction of the different layers. Some of the layers or plates can be described as the melodic song, do, re, mi. Can you whistle the tune? Does it sound too familiar? If you heard it on an elevator, would it have its own recognizable identity? And the harmonic song, major or minor, diminished or augmented chords or intervals. Is there a sense of resolution? The rhythmic song, dum diddle dum 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 dum. Can you dance to it? Does it have its own distinctive rhythmic identity? A friend reminded me that Poe's poem, The Raven, could be sung to deck the halls. Once upon a midnight dreary, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la. And Robert Frost, Stopping by Woods, works well with the melody to Hernando's Hideaway. Whose woods are these? I think I know. Then there's the rhyme scheme of the song. A-B-A-B, A-A-B-B, A-A-B-C, D-D-E-C. That's one of my favorites. Are there thoughtful lines, interesting ideas? Are they presented in a conversational and singable way? Has the songwriter considered the structure of the song? Verse, chorus, bridge, refrain, intro, outro, fade, tempo changes, instrumental breaks, and riffs. Does the song have a story? Is the second verse merely a restatement of the first verse? Is there a sense of having made progress in the course of the song? What about the essential concept that brought the song about? Usually the title or the bottom line. Is it valid? Is it worthy of a song? Are there musical or lyrical devices that hook the listener? Think about, I can't get no satisfaction. Isn't that a double hook, musical and lyric? Is there a quality of nonverbal, synesthetic expression to the song? Does it appeal to the senses? And who are the characters in the song? Are they interesting? Can the listener empathize? Is the language in character? And who's speaking? Is he or she intensely involved or dispassionate, ironic, humorous, wistful? Singing to someone in particular, do we believe we know this person? Is it me? Now, as some of you are beginning to suspect, these considerations are not just about writing songs. Any kind of writing that you do can benefit from looking into these kinds of things. But there's another consideration that I've wanted to bring up, which builds on the work of this first book. I've thought about writing a book called How to Write a Hit Song and Why, because I think that attaining some skill with these elements of expression begins to suggest what you might be able to say and to whom and why. Samuel Goldwyn is famous for saying, if I want to send a message, I'll call Western Union. He was not very tolerant of writers and directors who wanted to use their platform to raise awareness of social or political issues. And yet, in spite of this attitude, many wonderful films were made in the golden era of Hollywood, which admirably instruct us in the best of what humans are capable of. The poet William Carlos Williams wrote, it is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. All songs have a spiritual component. That's because melody, harmony, rhythm, and language all have emotional attributes which speak directly to a very deep place in each of us. When there is the presence of an understanding on the part of the writer and the intent to communicate soulfully, the effect can be very powerful, and the song may take on a life of its own. When we think of songs that affected some change in the world, or at least a change in how we see the world, of course, the tendency is to list the most famous songs, and often that reflects the priority of the corporate media more than an honest assessment of the needs of the public for inspiration. Many writers have complained that there is always encouragement for songs that can make money, but not so much for songs that carry the mail. Often called protest songs, songs of social relevance have been written by people participating in movements about abolition or prohibition or women's suffrage, the labor movement, the human rights movement, civil rights, the Native American rights movement, anti-war, the feminist movements, LGBTQ plus rights, animal rights, legalization of marijuana, and environmentalism. John Lennon's song, Imagine, seems to be at the top of so many lists, but there has been a long tradition of the use of songs to change people's thinking going back thousands of years. In 1929, the anti-lynching song, Strange Fruit, was written by Abel Mirapol and recorded by Billie Holiday. It contains the lyrics, Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. In the 30s, Fats Waller wrote Black and Blue. What did I do to be so black and blue? Woody Guthrie wrote Deportee based on a newspaper clipping about migrant workers being flown to Mexico and dying in a plane crash at Los Gatos Canyon. Pete Seeger wrote Where Have All the Flowers Gone and Waist Deep in the Big Muddy about the Vietnam War. He also helped to popularize the anthem We Shall Overcome. Seeger was placed under FBI surveillance and blacklisted by the entertainment industry during the McCarthy era. In the 60s, Phil Oakes wrote I Ain't Marchin' Anymore and Draft Dodger Rag and There But For Fortune and Changes and so many other great songs. Buffy St. Marie wrote Universal Soldier, recorded by many, including the British singer Donovan. Tom Paxton wrote Lyndon Johnson Told the Nation about the escalation of the war in Vietnam. The first protest song to reach number one in the United States was P.F. Sloan's song, The Eve of Destruction, sung by Barry McGuire in 1965. Since then, there have been too many great songs of social relevance to mention, from Bob Marley, Curtis Mayfield, U2, Pink Floyd, Sam Cooke, and so many others. But now that you have this new understanding, these new songwriting skills, isn't there something that you'd like to say? In order to break through to the larger audience, you might find, as Peter, Paul, and Mary said, that you have to lay it between the lines, but we know how to do that. Probably the best I can do is implore you to go forth and inspire a suffering nation to persevere and arise to a new ideal. One old friend of ours, Don Lang, wrote a song about the near meltdown of Three Mile Island called Take the Children and Run. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, separately and together, have recorded many songs of social relevance, such as Teach Your Children Well and Please Come to Chicago. But they also sang Take the Money and Run. Let that be a lesson to you. Thank you.